This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple. Futuro.
I view it as very colonial, the idea that everybody needs to be able to do this by this time so that way everybody can blah, blah, blah. I understand the philosophy, right? We want our children to be prepared, but if we're not actively investing in our students being prepared for the actual condition and life that they're going to live, then we're just giving them all these tools and the skill set and nothing to hang it on, nothing to apply, nothing that actually really matters.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, teaching Chicano history, now and then. Two Chicano educators in conversation. More than 25 years ago, Nadine Cordova, along with her sister Patsy, made history.
For years, they were considered outstanding teachers at the tiny school in Vaughan, New Mexico, until they were suspended for refusing to teach the prescribed curriculum. More specifically, they didn't want the sisters to teach Chicano history.
This is a news clip from a local Albuquerque television station in 1999. Although they later became known for teaching Chicano history, Nadine and Patsy only learned about the movement as adults. They read about the struggles Mexican Americans faced and the fight for labor rights, land, and a political identity in the United States during the 1960s and early 70s. The Chicano movement, as it's called, changed how Patsy and Nadine thought about themselves and their history. And both teachers wanted to share that with their students too.
I grew up being very ashamed of who I was, being a Mexican-American or a Chicana. I identify as a Chicana. And I refused at that point to do to my students what had been done to me in the public system.
Nadine, did you feel the same way?
I feel that way. I feel like our language, our history, and our culture, that's our foundation. And without our foundation, you know, we cannot succeed.
After that, they were fired. The school administration claimed that the Cordova sisters, especially Nadine, were teaching, quote, racial intolerance and promoting, quote, a militant attitude in their students. Looking back almost three decades later, Nadine still remembers what a difficult experience that was.
All the accusations and all the hateful things they say about you when you know you're doing a good job and you know you've given so much, because teachers give so much. And then to be treated like that, it's not easy.
Still, the Cordova sisters fought back. They filed a lawsuit against the school district, and eventually they won more than $500,000 out-of-court settlement and the option to be reinstated to their jobs. Nadine and Patsy both declined to go back, but they didn't stop teaching. They moved to Albuquerque and recently retired after a long career as public school teachers. But this is not a story that has stayed in the past. Educators who choose to teach, as Nadine and her sister did, are still facing consequences. Last year in Denver, Colorado, Tim Hernandez went through something similar. His contract wasn't renewed at North High School after teaching Chicano history and literature to his students.
I didn't just want to teach English. I have my degree in English, right? But I wanted to teach ethnic studies. And I wanted to teach Latino literature, to go right back to my community and give an educational experience that's rooted in pride and empowerment that I never got in school. And more importantly, that kids today are still not getting in school.
So we asked Tim and Nadine, more than 400 miles apart, if they wanted to meet virtually to talk about their shared experiences.
Hello, my friend.
Hey, how are you, amiga? It's so good to see you, hear from you.
So good to talk to you also.
After hearing about each other's stories, they had an instant connection and began corresponding.
I've been talking to my sons about you.
Dude, I've been talking to my kids about you. I've been talking about all kinds. I've been so hyped for this.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Today on our show, Tim and Nadine share why Chicano history is still relevant for kids, and they reflect on the struggles they've faced and the lessons they've learned. Here are Nadine Cordova and Tim Hernandez in conversation.
The way I see it, the system loves the teachers that stay in their place. Don't make any waves, don't create any issues, or don't ask for too much. And I just don't think that's fair. It's not fair to our students because it seems like teachers, we should teach from our heart and we should be giving them knowledge that is for their heart and for their soul.
I mean, like, to be blunt with you, Nadine, like, that's why I was placed on administrative leave, right? Like, I was told I wouldn't be returning to North High School. They openly, in a 5-minute meeting after teaching there for a year and a half, they said, hey, you're not coming back next year. I'm sorry.
Wow. The school that I worked at was mostly immigrant students. And I remember I was taking some classes for ESL. And I don't remember exactly where I was, you know, learning like all these quotes from the Mexican Revolution, Emiliano Zapata. And I love the quote of, you know, I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees. So my husband's from Chihuahua and I was so excited. I told him, you know, I'm going to do all these quotes. I'm going to do this about Emiliano Zapata. And he told me, te van a correr. Because, you know, he experienced all the racism and for his whole life, he experienced the racism. He told me they were going to fire me. And I thought, why in the world would they fire me?
Oh, wow. I started my first day at North High School was in January of 2021. And I was so excited. I grew up a couple blocks down the street. And so I was all excited and jazzed up. And I got there and the kids were like half asleep. And I was like, oh man, this is everything I did my degree for, right?
Right, exactly.
What about you, amiga?
I think when I first started teaching, because I decided to go into special education and just regular education, I think I did a lot of the traditional things, you know, what most teachers do, you know, the textbooks and this and that. It took a long time for me to feel comfortable. When I started including more topics that were relevant, and I would get response from students in the writing, how creative, how passionate they were about their writing and what they were doing and how involved they were, I think that is when I really got into the groove of how I wanted to teach and what kind of teacher I wanted to be, and totally non-traditional. Yeah. And that's what creates problems in the, you know, with principals and superiors. If you're totally non-traditional, they really expect you to be on this chapter of the literature book by this time of the year. And, you know, the literature books are crazy. My sister, she taught high school English and she would have topics like my life as a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader, my life as a shoe, you know, that kind of thing. When there were so many things going on in their world that would make it much more relevant for them to write about it. So that's why we chose to be non-traditional.
Yeah.
And that is something that they just are not comfortable with.
And that they're not ready for. Last year when I was at North, I was like, every week I would have to justify what I was teaching and why we were teaching this. And there were so many caveats and so many perspectives that people wanted to insert into what I was teaching. We have this hyper standardization and standards and testing and all these things.
It's bad. So many politics involved. You know, the principals, the superintendent, they all have their own ideas, the school boards. And then at the state level, you know, they want to put this curriculum in and this, you know, more testing. And then now in the higher levels, it's that all these people that know nothing about education, about being in the classroom, know better than us. Everybody can do better than us. And it just becomes too political, too much pressure. It's not wanting our creativity. All they want is for you to fit their little standards. Prove that you're doing this. It's just very stressful.
I think like it becomes really transactional. And because we view teaching as transactional, I one time had a conversation with a parent who disagreed with what I was teaching. And they said, oh, well, this is what I think my students should be taught, right? This is what I think. Ooh, and yeah. I remember having like a very clear moment with the parent and empathetically, right? Like I was not interested in making them feel bad, but I said, look, like your perspective on your child's education matters to me, and it will never matter more than your child's perspective on their education, right? Because I think actually your students probably know what they need more than you and I both do, right? That
right.
More than even sometimes I do. And I think when we have an education system that is really based upon adult opinions rather than student experiences, right? We,
yes,
of course, we're creating something that our students don't respond to more often than not.
Exactly. I remember I used to, in my classes, I would ask them, what are the topics that you are interested in that are relevant to you? Like in our community, there was a lot of teen pregnancy and drugs and alcohol and violence. And we would develop units around that. I'd find as many materials as I could find, and we would develop units around whatever interested them. So they bought into their curriculum. I love teaching that way.
Well, and I think it's really how teaching is supposed to work, right? Like learning is supposed, it's not supposed to be transactional because learning is relational. Students are not the hard part of teaching.
Yes, exactly.
They're not, you know, difficult and complex things that I think our education system often makes them out to be. I think that students are kids, and kids who are surviving the best way that they can according to the ways that their family have taught them, according to the resources that they have available. I work with kids who are unhoused. I work with kids who, you know, have been formerly incarcerated. I work with students who, you know, are working till 1 a.m., 2 a.m. every night after school because their family needs money, right? And so when they're in the classroom with me, right, my only job is to tell them thank you. And I think a lot of people in teaching, especially nowadays, I think have this idea of like, oh, I have to go teach. I have to go teach my kids. I have to do this. And I remember having a conversation with one of my teaching mentors, and she reframed it for me. And she said, you know, like a lot of people say they have to teach, but really it's that we get to teach.
Right.
I get to walk into a classroom and I get to work with my students and I get to teach and learn and love and laugh and experience a small part of life for them and for me, but a really formative interaction that I know is going to change me and change them because it does every time. They're the reason why we go in Monday through Friday, right? We can't even take a day off. My kids are texting me and calling me and being like, where are you?
I mean, there are a lot of pressures in the classroom, the grading systems, the kind of record keeping you have to keep, but the students are the joy. And you do have those students that are going to not like what you are teaching and will give you trouble. And, you know, I think that they're probably listening to you and it was making a difference. And sometimes we don't see it at that time, but we'll see it later. It is. I mean, I think as a teacher, you've got to feel passion for teaching. You need to love teaching. You need to teach from your heart. And the day that no longer can happen, then you don't belong in a classroom.
I think it's like teaching is such a gift to be given, right? To like anybody can be a teacher. I really do deeply believe that. Now, should everybody be a teacher? Maybe not. That's a personal opinion. You feel me? Anybody can be a teacher because I think teaching inherently is about just cultivating and listening to youth and giving them space to become the people that they want to be. And when we exist in a system that isn't really existed in preserving their hearts and their souls and their spirits and their minds, I think it's even more radical to center that.
Yes, right.
Coming up on Latino USA, Nadine Cordova and Tim Hernandez dive into the parallels of their stories and talk about what it takes to make changes in the public education system. Stay with us. No te vayas.
You've probably heard the stereotypes.
I'm just thinking of all the like Mercury and retrograde memes.
The Scorpio side of me is like, absolutely not.
I'm an Aquarius. It's like the visionary energy in me.
But there's so much more to astrology. I'm Issa Nakazawa. Join me on Stars and Stars with Issa, a new podcast where I welcome some of the most talented stars of our time to find what their birth chart reveals about them and their purpose.
I'm laughing because I'm like, these are two big topics in my life.
This golden eagle resonates and this phoenix resonates.
It's crazy because I feel all those ways at once.
Listen to Stars and Stars with Issa wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow the show so you never miss an episode.
We're back. Before the break, we were listening to a conversation between Nadine Cordova and Tim Hernandez, two teachers who almost three decades apart were fired after teaching Chicano history to their students. Now they reflect on their shared struggles and talk about what kind of hope they see for the future of public education. Here are Tim and Nadine once again.
I was born and raised in Vaughan, New Mexico, and that's right in the center of New Mexico towards the east. And I discovered later in my life that all the communities around us were racist, that my brothers and sisters would go to basketball games and maybe an hour away in Fort Sumner and Corona, and there were colored water fountains and the white water fountains. I grew up very isolated. Vaughan is very small. It seems like there's no contact with the outside world. And so I didn't know a lot of things when I was growing up. I do remember being very poor. I didn't know we were poor. And I just really didn't see the connection with the life I was living, the life my father was living, and what farm workers are going through, and the movement of Cesar Chavez. Not till later in my life, which is really sad. I was already 27 when I started learning Chicano studies.
No, it's real. I mean, I think we're talking about the differences between urban and rural context of education, right? And Chicanismo, really. I think we're talking about like generational differences too, right? Like I was raised by people who are Chicanos who taught me key philosophies and just understanding who I was. I was born in Pueblo and I grew up in kinship family foster care. So I lived with a lot of my different family members when my biological parents couldn't take care of me. My biological mother passed. So I went to schools literally all over the place. I went to 8 schools before the 7th grade. We lived on the north side of Denver, which is a really formative and historic place for Chicano people, for Chicano community. It was a huge part of the Chicano movement that swept through in the 1960s in Colorado. When I was in high school, I wanted to be a part of that. And I didn't get the chance to go to our local public high school because my parents didn't trust it because there were a lot of gangs and there was a lot of violence. And so my parents sent me to a small charter school. So when I became a teacher, I knew I wanted to go back to my community, but I knew I wanted to teach at the public school. And I wanted to do that for the specific reason that my community has been extremely gentrified, Nadine. And we've seen our community disappear. The work that I now actively do in really activating a lot of students towards their own identities, whether they're Chicano or whatever word they want to ascribe themselves to be, right? Like, was the same work that people gave to me. And I think a lot about how a lot of that is rooted in access and education and privilege, because learning your history is a privilege and politicizing yourself is a privilege from that, right?
Right. It wasn't until I learned later in life, you know, who we were, how we came to be, that I decided that I could not do that to the kids that were in my classroom. They had to have some knowledge to give them a framework. To me, I see knowing your history and being proud of your ancestors is like your suit of armor.
So Nadine, you went to the community that you were from and you taught in a really intimate environment. And so I want you to walk me through maybe what was that transition? What was that moment? At what point did you begin to just very clearly make the decision of like, we're not going to do this anymore because it's not working. It's not, our students aren't responding to it. It's not what we need right now. And instead, I'm going to put forth what I know we actually need.
When I went to Eastern New Mexico University, I took my first Chicano history class and I was in a special education program. And I remember a professor saying, if you are not teaching relevant education, then you are not teaching. And that is something that I carried with me, but I didn't have that much information. I had taken that the Chicano humanities class, so I had that one book. So I would try to share as much information from that one book. And there was, you know, it wasn't easy to find information. Just all of a sudden, I would see an announcement that the Chicano Civil Rights Movement was coming out on PBS.
Coming up next on Chicano, the history of the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement.
And I'm so old that I recorded them on the big VCR tapes.
Okay, that's how old I am.
Okay, so I recorded all the Chicano Civil Rights Movement. It was a 4-part series, and I thought, I am going to take this to the classroom. We are going to, you know, learn about it. We're going to write about it. You know, I'm going to expose my kids to this history. And I remember when I was showing the Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Movement, I remember feeling like very sad, very emotional, but a little nervous. And I knew that it was going to be so different for them. And I used to tell them, you know, I'm not telling you that you're Mexican-American. I'm not telling you you're Chicano. I'm telling you, you know, whatever you call yourself, if you call yourself Spanish, Chicano, Latino, whatever, this is information that applies to all of us.
I hear what you're saying, and I know where that comes from for me. I poured everything into my kids, and I sought information, and I sought community, and I brought people in. I think it's really beautiful to hear you express a similar sentiment that you didn't do it alone either, right? It was kind of a community of folks giving you resources and information and structures and frameworks that have historically worked for our communities, right? Like, I think that that's really formative. And I'm really curious, how did that feel for you? How did it feel practicing those things with students for the first time?
I was so passionate about what I was doing. I felt such passion. I was, what they called it, the community members and the lawyers, is that my sister and I were overzealous.
Overzealous.
But I think all teachers should be overzealous, right? Be excited about teaching.
Jeez, oh, say that, yeah.
So my students are learning all these things. I read about a group called Mecha in Las Vegas, New Mexico. So I told my students about this group, that they were learning about their history and that they did community service. I asked them if they would like to start a group like that, and they were so excited. They chose officers, they had their plan, they were going to read to the young, they were going to put up luminarias, they were going to go clean the cemetery. They just wanted to do all this community service. They were just so pumped. And it was just so beautiful to see that. And then when we started the school year, I believe it was in 97, the officers got up to do a presentation on Mecha. They wanted to include more students. They told them what they were going to do. They were going to read books. They were, you know, going to get points. So what happened is that one of my officers, she, as they were going to sit down, she let out a, que viva la raza, que viva el Chicano. You could have heard a pin drop. And that's what started the attack on my sister and I.
I don't know. I think a lot about how, like, it wasn't anything that you openly indoctrinated the kid, right? Like, we're in this weird kind of political state of education where people don't believe that kids know what's best for themselves, right? So, like, for kids to respond to that and then to, like, embody that, right? And to ultimately step into it and say, que viva la raza, right? And to shout it, it comes, like, at a, like, that's a very clear challenge to a system that might not be working for students.
Right. I mean, we're not going to change everybody, but we are going to change some of those students.
Even if it's one.
Yes, even if it's one.
I think that we know what's best for kids when really they know, right? Like, I also facilitate a Mecha club, right? And that's one of the reasons I was fired, right? Like, and if kids are in a club, right, and they're all actively showing up after school, I mean, we did all kinds of stuff. Like, kids were going hungry, so we raised money in the community and had a community fridge. We facilitated the club based upon what the students said that they wanted, whether that was political or material or whatever, right? Like, and giving students agency like that is radical, right? In an education system that is much more interested in clipping their wings, right, than teaching them how to fly. I don't know, man. I get kind of emotional thinking about how everybody believes that education needs to be this apolitical, like, neutral thing. And here you came and you said, hey, actually, like, according to my students, needs according to the communities that we live in, according to the ways that our community is trying to lead us. This is actually the politics that we need, right? And I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on, you know, the political things that you did in the classroom?
Well, I remember that I was being attacked. One student let out that Viva la Raza, Viva el Chicano, you know, they started really, you know, watching me and not agreeing with what I was doing and not wanting me to do the Mecha group. But no matter what they told me, I kept on.
Yeah.
I was under attack, but I kept on in what I believed in. And I remember that at that time, too, a Newsweek magazine article came out about the Latino March on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my students were like eighth grade. They read the article and they had to put what they, you know, thought about this and, you know, why were they marching and, you know, why it was important. And the essays that they wrote were beautiful.
Man.
Roberto Rodriguez wrote in there that a march is a prayer in motion.
Mm.
And some of the students would put that in their writing. I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I decided that I was going to take some students to Washington. And I took 5 students to Washington, D.C. for the march.
Wow.
And that really did not sit well with the school board. With this. I just can't understand why. That was just an unbelievable experience.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that much longer. I believe it was in March that they suspended us.
What was it like the day that you were placed on administrative leave?
It was very strange. I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I had already been speaking to my ACLU attorneys, how they wanted to shut us down, how they didn't want us to do the MECHA.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already started to collect information because I believe, you know, I really thought they were going to fire me, and they did. I knew I needed everything documented because they were going to deny what they told me, and I would send the superintendent a letter and I would ask, can I announce my MECHA meetings on the intercom? Can I send out flyers? Can we put up posters? And everything he said, no, 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 no. He said no, but guess what? They could announce catechism. They could announce baby showers on the intercom, but I couldn't announce my group on the intercom or put up posters. They were just attacking it.
Of course.
And we tried to hang on for as much as possible. But during the Christmas break, the custodian told us they did this. They were dropped off there. They went into our classrooms to search. Because, see, they were accusing us of teaching racism, of teaching militancy, of teaching them that to forget they were American first. They were making all these accusations. But then they had to go into the classroom too so that they could find something to prove that we were doing these things. And they could find nothing. They found a Chicano Studies poster from the Chicano movement. And it's got graduates, it's got families, it's got farm workers. It's a beautiful poster. At the bottom, it's got like a silhouette of graduates with their diploma. So they videotaped that and they took that out during depositions. They were deposing my sister. And they asked her, what is this, you know, this poster? Can you tell us about it? Yeah, they've got graduates. It's got the Virgen de Guadalupe. It's got farm workers. And she went on and talked about the poster. And the attorney said, and what is that silhouette at the bottom? And she said, it's the graduates holding their diploma. And he says, what? And he zoomed in the VCR tape. And there's the graduates coming in with their diploma. They've really thought that silhouette had weapons, that it was weapons that they were holding in their hand. That's
how
crazy they got with their accusations. And so when she said it was the graduates and he zoomed it, then he turned off the TV and we never heard about that poster again.
Can I ask a real quick question? I know that you went through this and it was really hard and emotional. How was it going through it with your sister?
Yeah, that was very helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what kept us strong. I mean, not only being proud of who we were, as women, as Chicanas, being together and traveling together and speaking together, it made it much easier. It would have been really lonely to do this alone. So I can imagine, I mean, for you.
I think it's really powerful to hear you talk about that. When I think about why the Chicano movement worked, right? I think there's, you and I both know, there's a lot of failures of the Chicano movement too.
Right.
But when I think about what worked, that's what I think about is the most transformative part is that's what it was about. It was about people doing things together. That's all it was. It was campesinos in the fields talking to each other and deciding that they wanted to be paid fairly. It was Chicanos in San Luis and these other places in Tierra Maria, right? And
right.
Getting together and doing something together, whether it's taking back land or fighting for a fair contract or fighting for better schools. Even when we think about key philosophies, right, that really create the foundation of the Chicano movement, all it is it's an expression of who we are together. I think it's really formative to hear you kind of talk about that. Because although I do think I'm going through this kind of by myself, and, you know, I wish, tell your sister if she wants to come help out, she's welcome to, you feel me?
Yeah.
I think it's something that I'm still coming to terms with and I'll have to really figure out for myself, but it is really refreshing to hear how integral community was to the experience that you had. I don't know. I think a lot about what happened to me, Nadine, and it makes me really emotional because hearing what happened to you and hearing that you're on the other side of things from what you experienced and the legal battles that you went through, it's wild to hear that, you know, we didn't talk before all this, right? Like, you weren't coaching me throughout the entire year, but we ended up in the same place for the same reasons.
Right, right.
Because the system doesn't work. It's not you, it's not me. I ultimately was placed on administrative leave from my school district because I didn't stay in my place. I started speaking out about it. I went to the press. I said, hey, here's what happened to me. I'm not sure what we can do about it, but I do think that you and I both know, Nadine, that we're not the first nor the last nor the only Chicano, Black, Indigenous, Asian teachers who are forced out of the classroom.
Right.
When I was fired, there were student actions that developed and took place. Our Metro Club began organizing protests.
Wow.
When I came back, Nadine, that next week, there was already a week of student action. Kids had it planned. They did an art demonstration on Monday where they printed out 4,000 of these wanted posters where they put their own face and it said, wanted teachers who look like me.
Oh, wow. Oh, that is so awesome.
And they threw them off the balcony.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was not allowed to communicate with them. I was not helping them organize. I was not given any information. I was just hearing from other teachers who were like, did you know this is happening? And I was like, well, I'm not in the loop with anything. And on that Friday, I knew the walkout was happening. My students walked out at the beginning of the day, right when school started, and hundreds of students went to the park across the street from our school. And I was sent to a meeting for my first period, and they put it on the other side of the building so that I couldn't see the kids from the windows. And when I was walking to my second period class, students had been out there for about 45 minutes chanting, as I was walking back, I remember I was walking towards my room and I saw outside and I saw the students for the first time and there were hundreds of them. And they were outside in the park and I had no intention of walking out. My legal counsel had advised, please don't walk out. You will not be able to get a job. Do not walk out. Do not walk out. And I had told them that I wasn't going to. But at that moment, I got a phone call from Jasmine Gandaria, who is a really, really formative mentor of mine I met when I was student teaching. She said, hey, I just got a phone call from Dr. Falcon. And she said that you have to walk out. We have to do this. And she's like, I'm here. I'm at the protest. And I think that this is something that you really need to listen to. And so I walked into my classroom and I said, I'm leaving. And so I walked out. And I met my students on the corner of Federal and Spear in the middle of the street. And we marched.
Hey, we only got a little bit of ways to go. Y'all still got energy. Yeah! I can't hear you. Y'all still got energy. Yeah! Chicano!
Immediately when I got back to the school, right, they put me on administrative leave. I was escorted out by security and I was told like I would not be able to be on school property and all these other things. And so it became really formative to me. And more importantly, I think really speaks to your point that like I was not placed on administrative leave for not servicing my kids.
I don't know if Tim, if I told you this, but for my firing, let me go back a little bit and this is how backwards they were in Vaughan is that the mayor of the town, he actually called the National Guard on this to be there for the firing.
Oh, man.
He just whipped the town like into a frenzy because I was suspended in March and then we got fired in July. And I remember that we, our attorneys advised us not to be at that hearing, you know, when they were going to decide if they were going to fire us. And from Albuquerque, they brought a bus, the director of Chicano Studies and also the leader of the Cesar Chavez Foundation and a preacher and professors and all kinds of people came down for our firing to support us. And they did a prayer circle and they did, you know, they were there, but we weren't there to see it.
Oh, man.
And I thought that was beautiful, too, that they were there to support our kids, but they had to come from Albuquerque. And I know some parents were there, but I think in the small town like Juan, they were kind of like, they kind of scared of what was going on and they just didn't understand, you know?
Of course, yeah.
The majority of the community had their children in our classrooms and all that, and they trusted us, but they just didn't understand why all this was going on. And I don't think they really knew what to do.
But I will say what stands out is, I mean, like I think about your Mecha Club, hearing the ways that you taught students about who they were. And I deeply believe, right, La Lucha Sigue, right? Like it's a huge part of my life. But to hear the world that we have in the state of education for our students is not working, is not performing in the way that we need to for our students. So to hear the similarities in what we're doing and how we both openly challenged and were fearless in the ways that we confronted a system that is not yet ready to change and become what it needs to be for our students. It's an affirmation to me that like we have to be on the right path.
And I think about how powerful these materials, this poetry, the literature, the stories are to our students. I remember when my Mecha students met with the school board members and the superintendent because, you know, they wanted to know why they felt, you know, it was important to learn this. And I remember I had one Mecha member. He was a young student. I'm not going to mention any names. But he told them it's really important for us to learn this. And he was quoting the Corky Gonzalez poem. You know, he said, we cry the same, we laugh the same. He was
used. Look the same, yeah.
And for that one student, you know, it was important to have this, but we got ripped out. And I wonder how it hurt some of our students.
I think about that almost every day. I mean, I hear from my Norse students every week. They call me, they text me still, right? Like we're still in good communication. I talk to them about what their schooling experiences are like now, and it's really hard and we cry every time.
So what are you going to do, Tim? Are you really going to fight to go back? Because what's going to happen with the connections you've made at your new school, though?
Eventually, I would like to go back to North High School, and I'm not sure at what rate. I'm not sure if it's a couple of years, right? I'm not sure if it's at the end of my life.
Right.
But I do think I want to be able to experience walking back into that school and telling my students that if we fight for the right thing, we will win. When we fight, we will win 100% of the time. It's not a question. I think I would like to go back to North High School eventually, and I'd like to go back and really just hug my students and tell them how much I miss them and tell them that even though this is really hard, that I know that it's going to be worth it.
I think that it'd be good because you have a large community support and a large student support. For me, because it was such a small community, that it would have been a hostile environment. Community members that had made it look so scary, and it just felt like it was going to be a hostile environment for me and my sons. And I couldn't go back. I could have gone back. That was part of the settlement, but I just couldn't do it.
I'm in litigation with Denver Public Schools right now. And to hear that even if I don't go back to North High School, that it's still worth it, I think is really grounding. I think it makes me feel very, just really affirmed. I think it's probably one of the clearest messages of hope I've received in a long time, to be honest with you. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Nadine.
You're welcome.
I know that if we fight, we will win, but to talk to somebody who has openly fought in the same ways that I'm planning on fighting, it's just, it's really powerful. I don't think I'm ever going to forget this conversation with you.
I'm never going to forget the conversation with you, Tim, because you inspire me and you give me so much hope for our future and for our young people, because if there's not teachers like you, then I have no hope. What I believe is that we continue marching, we continue speaking, and we cannot back down.
Every teacher has a story of this either happened to them or it happened to a Black or Brown teacher that they knew. It makes me feel kind of daunted sometimes that we're trying to change a system And it also makes me feel very affirmed that in no way am I going to have to do this alone or by myself. I'm 25 years old, right? Like, I've got a lot of years of being a teacher left.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm really excited for that. And I know that what happened to me was really painful and really hard, but I'm also very glad that it happened publicly, because the next time a school in Denver Public Schools fires a Black or brown teacher without a good reason, I hope that they think twice. I hope that they have to. I just want to thank you so much for choosing to fight in a way that gives me hope.
I thank you too for, you know, listening to your amazing, and I'm so proud, you know, that we have gotten to know each other and that we know about each other's story, and your story continues. And I'm just really very proud of what you've done and what your students did. And it just gives me a lot of hope.
We reached out to officials at North High School and the Denver Public Schools District in Colorado, requesting a comment on Tim's dismissal last year, but they didn't respond. Coming up on Latino USA, we hear from two of Nadine's and Tim's former students. Stay with us, no te vayas. Hey, we're back. Before the break, we heard the story of Nadine Cordova and Tim Hernandez, two teachers from different generations and different states, who each got fired because they taught Chicano history. Throughout their conversation, we heard how Nadine and Tim both believe in centering the experiences of their students in their classrooms and how important it is to listen to student voices. So we wanted to do the same. We're going to hear now from Nadine's former student, Regina Luna, and Tim's student, Nayeli Lopez.
My name is Nayeli Lopez. I'm 15 years old. I'm a sophomore at Denver North High School.
My name is Regina Luna. I'm 43 years old. I live in Edgewood, New Mexico.
So the first time I met Tim, well, Mr. Hernandez, as I like to call him, was like a reopening of West High School. I remember I barely started my freshman year. I was the only North student there. I remember feeling a little out of place. Next thing you see is Tim and like a group of students and another teacher come in, and they have this big old banner, and it says, "From North to West, Chicano Power, Chicanx Power." I thought that was like the coolest thing ever, and it's like, oh my God, he's a teacher at North. I want him to be my teacher.
The first time that I met Nadine, I was in elementary. I mean, we always knew them, her and her sister, but the first time I really, really interacted with her was probably in fifth grade. So I was maybe about 10 or so. It was probably about 1988, 89. And then I had them off and on until I was a senior, which was in 1997. They were a strong influence on us right from the beginning. They were different. They did things different.
I remember like the first time walking into his classroom, I instantly felt at home. I saw like papel picado hung up. I saw a big old poster of like Aztec calendar. I saw like the UFW flag that was hung. And I was like, I've never, ever seen that in a school setting.
What I remember most about being in Nadine's class was learning a lot of useful things that we would take with us in everyday life. In her class, she was teaching us a lot of how to deal with emotions, how to deal with life in general, how to deal with situations that would arise.
Mr. Hernandez was definitely the youngest teacher that I've had. And a lot of people think that's not that important, but it is, because especially when you're in high school, you can connect with your teacher a lot better. Last year, I used to always wait after school, and we had a community fridge after school. All the students were hungry, especially me. I was really hungry, so I would go to his classroom right when the bell rang, and I would grab a snack and sit down, and I would tell him about my day and just use that space to just decompress and go over my day.
I was always the type of person that was just interested in doing something different. So when the Mecha Club came about, it was like, oh wow, what's this? You know, this is actually something different. We've never heard of this before.
I was in Mecha last year. So Mecha stands for Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aslan. In English, it means Chicano Student Movement of Aslan, Aslan being like the land, the homeland of the Aztecs, the Mexica, before they migrated down to Mexico, well, present-day Mexico.
We hear about this club that we could start that was actually about our culture, about our race, which at that time, we didn't really know of anything like that, as you know, especially where we live. So just being a part of that club when it first started and then reading more about our culture, I mean, it felt good. It felt, you know, like, why don't we know more about this? When you have a teacher bringing in this organization and starting this club, and you have all your peers around you wanting to learn the same thing and wanting to know the same thing, it hits different. It's like, okay, well, you know, I'm gonna actually learn about myself with my peers, with my friends, and I'm gonna be able to talk to people my age about how I feel and about what I think. I feel like I probably gained more confidence in myself. I feel I did.
I mean, I was already so shocked and like excited that there was a Mecha at my high school. So just like stepping into his class and meeting him was very empowering.
When Nadine was starting to face dismissal, I remember feeling the tension. Not only did I feel tension from being in that classroom around that time, but just being in the school in general. Nothing really scared Nadine and Patsy, it seemed at the time. It just seemed like they were fearless. They continued to teach us how they started at the beginning of the year. And it almost felt like maybe, you know, we were doing something wrong. Like, we're not supposed to be learning this.
That day we knew that Mr. Hernandez was going to hear news about his interview before, about coming back to work at North the next year. So me and another student went to his classroom after school. He had to go into the meeting, which was like directly behind his classroom. We wanted to wait in the classroom just to hear the news, and hopefully it was good news and we can celebrate with him. But when he went into the meeting, what was 5 minutes felt like 30 seconds. The next thing you know, he comes through the door. The only word he says is no. And then he walked out again and started taking everything down from the walls. I was in disbelief. I couldn't believe that our school would do that to us, not just to him, but to the students, to our community. I got my backpack and I left the classroom and I went to my mom's car. I was so upset. I just cried. I came back to school the next day. I was just like bummed out. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't feel productive. I didn't feel motivated. And that was the same for a lot of other students. Like, he wasn't just a great form of representation for his students, but also he was a teacher that we could trust. And kids would get up every morning, and the only reason they were excited to go to school was because of him and his classroom.
When I learned that she was being dismissed, I felt pretty confused. I was going through a lot at that time. I was pregnant with my first child. I was a senior in high school. Nadine, you know, she would help me out a lot. She was always there for me to talk to. When she got dismissed, I was like, I just don't get it. I don't understand why this is happening.
My friends were in class. It was his Latinx literature class. When they walked into an empty classroom, and most of all, when they saw that their teacher was not there, they all walked out of his classroom. I remember running into my cousin who was in this class. She was like, "Where's Mr. Hernandez? Like, where's our teacher?" She looked like she was very upset. She was trying to ask, like, this counselor, "Where's our teacher?" And he's like, "Oh, I mean, I don't know, but you have to go back to class. Can I get you anything? Do you need anything?" And she goes, "Yeah, Mr. Hernandez." I think that was like a very funny but true moment.
We didn't know, you know, how to really speak up and stand up for them like we probably should have. But it's a small town and you just really don't want that retaliation. You know, whenever I did finally graduate high school, I had my baby. She was like 3 months old. I ended up being salutatorian. When I was doing my salutatory speech, I was told not to mention Nadine and Patsy. And of course, you know, I went up and did my speech and mentioned them anyway, which I got a few dirty looks for. Well, I got some cheers too. You know, there was some cheers that I actually mentioned them.
We started to organize. We met up at my friend's house, just like four of us, five of us, and we just started talking about next steps. And we were talking about, okay, when are we gonna walk out? We know we're gonna walk out for sure. What are we gonna do? Wednesday was a sit-in. Thursday, we threw off flyers from the balcony, and Friday, we walked out. The flyers that we made, it was a picture of like students. So we got like a bunch of students to take a picture of themselves and like kind of make them look like they were in a mugshot. And it said, "Wanted, teachers that look like us." We slide the flyers under the doors, and like teachers who supported would hang them up. We threw off the flyers from the balcony and we did a chant, specifically the Chicano Power chant. It was a call and response chant. So the call is Chicano and then people would respond power.
Chicano! Chicano!
I identify as Chicana, definitely. To me, being a Chicana, it's not just about where my ancestors were from. It's who I am. It's how I was raised. It's our traditions. It's our culture. It's how we live every day. It kind of makes you feel more empowered. It really does. You know, and it's kind of a strong word to use because people are afraid of people being empowered.
I grew up around some people from the Chicano movement. When I saw that being represented at North, I felt like way more empowered. And I finally knew what it truly meant to be Chicana. I mean, my dad would always say, well, he says, like, to be Chicana means to struggle. And I kind of understood that more. And I definitely identified myself more as a Chicana.
I think what I learned from Nadine does impact my life today. I said this in a Facebook post when I was acknowledging them one day. I can't even begin to appreciate and acknowledge all our heroes for, you know, all these movements. I can't begin to acknowledge them if I don't thank Nadine and Patsy first, because they're the ones that really started it for me. It's like anytime I think about how proud I am of who I am, I go back to them.
I mean, not only is Mr. Hernandez just a great teacher, but he's a really great mentor. He was one of the few teachers that truly represented me and that truly represents the North Side. School doesn't feel the same. So I'm definitely still healing. And the person that I went to for everything isn't at school. And I don't have a classroom where I feel like I truly belong. And I know it's crazy. It's almost been a year now that I'm thinking about it. It's almost been a year. And I'm still feeling a little out of place at school after everything that happened.
I think the last time I talked to Nadine and Patsy was, it's probably been a few months. I believe it was just a conversation about how we're doing, how my son's doing, how our families are doing. But I remember it feeling really good to know that my teachers, since I was in grade school, still followed me and my life to this day. Now that I'm 43 years old, we don't talk often, but when we do talk, we still have that strong connection. They're just genuine, caring people.
The biggest lesson Mr. Hernandez taught me is probably activism is not a game of passion, but a game of patience. And that phrase just stuck with me. Even if you have all the passion in the world and it drives you, it's not the thing that's going to get you to what you want. But you have to be patient, and it takes a long time. We're not going to see big change overnight. It's baby steps. Even if we just make a little progress, that's still a victory.
That was Regina Luna and Nayeli Lopez. This episode was produced by Victoria Estrada and Elizabeth Loenthal Torres. It was edited by Daisy Contreras and mixed by Julia Caruso and JJ Carubin. The Latino USA team includes Andrea Lopez Cruzado, Marta Martinez, Mike Sargent, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., Patricia Zulbarán, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Fernanda Santos. Our director of engineering is Stephanie LeBeau. Our associate engineer is Gabriela Baez. Our marketing manager is Luis Luna. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on social media at latinousa.org. And remember, no te vayas. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. Michelle Mercer and Bruce Golden. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Actually, this is like a fun fact. I was born on February 25th, 1997. And 3 days later, Patsy and Nadine were on administrative leave. So I don't know. Like, you feel me? Like,
I really feel old now.
I'm 25.
I really feel old now.
And so,
that's hilarious. From PR.